Here comes the 285th edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo. The home station is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Rebroadcasts on CHLS in Lillooet and CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake. On the 26th of September, CFUR's show of my worthy nemesis, Doug Strachan, he made some comments about me and my show that I cannot allow to pass unchallenged. Doug calls his show Common Sense, but he's never spelled it out. I'm reminded of sense, as in the common penny, masquerading as copper, but now a cheap alloy. But I digress. My apologies, Doug. Doug took me to task for calling one of Steve Harper's junior members of Parliament a stuffed shirt and a sycophant of George Bush's policies as adopted by our honorable Prime Minister. As Doug requested, I apologize. James Moore is not a stuffed shirt. I used that euphemism to soften my criticism. James Moore, MP, is a rude, pompous ass. I know this from coming across Mr. Moore in the UNBC cafeteria, where he was holding court with a political monologue for a handful of his admiring followers. My wife and I were drawn to hear him, and she made some comment. He was not impressed by someone daring to challenge him. I forget how the conversation went, but in the course of it she stated that she disagreed with him as she was a socialist. He immediately turned his back on her and returned to his admiring disciples. I read a piece penned by the Honorable Mr. Moore while he was a student. It appeared in that quarterly propaganda sheet put out by the Fraser Institute, which they call the Canadian Student Review. His essay was a sophomoric piece of drivel that might have earned a C in high school social studies course, and it was signed James Moore, B.A., Political Science, UNBC. This was interesting, as the Honorable Mr. Moore was still an undergraduate, and his B.A. at that point was wishful thinking. Mr. Moore subsequently jumped through the hoops and received a degree from UNBC. This does not mean that I should celebrate him, his party, nor its misguided policies. Although my opinion, Mr. Moore, is drawn from experience, I was taken to task by Doug Strachan, who claimed that I should not have made such an ad hominem attack on a respected public figure. Respect must be earned, and Mr. Moore has yet to earn mine. Doug proceeded to pass off a snide joke ridiculing Fidel Castro, a man widely revered in his own country. I suppose his opinion of Fidel is built on what is exposed to he is exposed to in the media, a media strongly influenced by official American antipathy. I doubt that Doug has visited Cuba nor talked with any of its citizens. I, however, have visited the island several times, the first being with the U.S. Army in Guantanamo. I've worked in Cuba as a volunteer. I've talked candidly with Cubans, and I can testify there's a great deal of respect in Cuba, even among critics, for their leader, who's worked tirelessly for his nation in the face of extreme hardships and sabotage by the most powerful nation on earth. They do not all agree with his policies, but I've found no Cubans who do not respect that leader's dedication. I can't think of a single leader of a capitalist nation of whom I can say the same. Fidel Castro stands head and shoulders above the Honorable Mr. Moore. Doug then smeared the Muslim faith. He claimed that fanaticism in some Muslims was due to Islam being less mature than Christianity by some 600 years. By this measure, Christianity stands less mature than Hinduism, Judaism, and Zoroastrianism, and older by far than all of these is atheism, which predates the invention of all religions. Christians stand on shaky ground in criticizing other religions for harboring fanatics. From the Crusades through the Inquisition on to today's wars in the Middle East, Christianity has suffered no lack of fanatics ready to shed the blood of unbelievers. Even today they can boast Ms. Palin, a woman who believes her nation is doing God's will by going to war. Fanaticism of all religions is to be deplored, but as the Bible says, look after the beam in your own eye before criticizing the mote in the eye of another. At least I'm more even-handed than Doug in my criticism of religions, as I exclude none. They're all, by definition, built upon faith and tenets that are beyond knowledge or proof. Interesting information arrived on the economic front. As the turmoil hits the financial houses dealing in virtual products, there's prosperity on two fronts where real products change hands. Outfits like Mallwart and McDonald's are doing fine as people are forced to go to them for cheap clothing and substitutes for real restaurant food. At the other end of the spectrum, Gucci and Hermes, purveyors of fancy branded goods to the rich, are also doing well. Isn't it a relief that those two in the upper reaches of the economic stratosphere aren't bearing the brunt of the gross mismanagement of governments and corporations? Those of you fortunate enough to live in Prince George and listen to me live have an opportunity to make some good buys tomorrow. There'll be another sale of surplus books at the Jeffrey Weller Library here at UNBC. As usual, the selection is eclectic and all sales will be by donation. Hours of operation will be 8:30 until about 2. I'll be there. Join me. At this point, I'll make some serious comments about life in the 21st century America. It's indisputable that both Canada and the U.S. have suffered a severe disintegration of our social safety nets in the last 30 years. What was once seen as a moral obligation of society to assure that none of our citizens starved or slept in the streets has been successfully attacked by the greedy and ignorant whose philosophy has become me first and to hell with the rest. Propagandists of the right have pushed this since the 70s when politicians have played on it to divert resources from working people and the destitute to the already well off. I defy you to deny this. There's a French phrase that I've not heard spoken for years. It is noblesse oblige, meaning literally, nobility obliges, or those of high birth, wealth, and social position should behave generously or nobly toward others. The rich used to take literally the teaching of Jesus that wealth is a temporary stewardship of resources and that Christians have a duty to aid the poor. In the wake of the Great Depression, governments accepted a degree of responsibility for the welfare of the poor. Publicly supported programs took over many good works from private charities. This relieved religious organizations of those tasks, serving as the rationalization for giving them freedom from taxation. I would now be embarrassed to call myself a Christian, seeing the callousness of so many of my fellow religionists toward the disadvantaged. The biblical lesson of the Good Samaritan has been lost on those prosperous Christians who blithely step over the destitute sleeping on the pavements of our great cities. A few churches do good works, but many others are conspicuous and caring for none but their own as they gather in tax-free contributions to invest in buildings, land, and endowments. Most CFUR listeners in Prince George are students, scraping along on student loans and part-time jobs. I'm not now speaking to you. I'm talking to those like myself who have achieved a level of prosperity where we don't have to worry about our next month's rent or tomorrow's dinner. I challenge you to go down 2nd Avenue to the St. Vincent de Paul facility around noontime any day and see the number of poor people who go there for a meal. I'm sure there are as many different stories as to what drove people to need free meals as there are diners there, but for many this place is all that keeps them from malnutrition or starvation. While you're down there, take a look at the traffic as expensive cars whiz by, their drivers not casting a glance as they go about their chores of shopping and superficial business. My wife and I are not religious, but we give to St. Vincent de Paul and similar charities. If you have the means, do you? As for those students who are now struggling, remember the poor if you achieve affluence yourself. Even if you join the army of Canadians who continue to struggle in the job market, find yourself just two paychecks away from destitution, you can always find a few bucks for charity. Cut back on those frivolous purchases and kick in some to help the poor. Someday you may find yourself in need of support. Everyone thinks it could not happen to them. Go down to St. Vincent de Paul and meet some. Noblesse oblige. Canada's spending great amounts of money on job training. Although it's a constant necessity to impart specific skills to the coming generation of workers, it will not reduce the rate of unemployment in our country. This may seem counterintuitive, and it would be if the job market were truly free. It is not. Economists postulate that what they call the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. This is a fancy term, meaning that there must be a certain percentage of the workforce unemployed at any given time to keep a lid on inflation. In the States, this has been arbitrarily pegged at 6%. According to theory, when unemployment falls below this rate, job shortages will develop, causing wages to rise. Those increases will work their way through the economy, much as gasoline prices are now ratcheting up all prices. If such a condition persists, the Federal Reserve will increase interest rates and rein in credit to cause the economy to contract and unemployment to rise. Canada does the same with the Bank of Canada, although we measure unemployment differently and have different tolerances for unemployment. With the influx of cheap stuff from China, there's a restraining effect on inflation, so a slightly lower rate of unemployment is being tolerated, but the principle is the same. When individuals, organizations, and local governments initiate programs to create jobs for the unemployed, they're blowing smoke. In the longer run, any gains will be met with constrictions to cut jobs elsewhere in the economy to bring us back to that non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. Under our current system of government and economy, there will never be a job for everyone who wants to work, as the system will not allow it. Those who try to put the jobless to work are just engaging in a national system of musical chairs for the unemployed. Whoever said capitalism was not a cruel system? For those of you who think the financial mess we face today is a compound of errors and misjudgments, I submit the following short essay by Thomas Frank, as it appeared in Harper's Magazine. He calls this The Wrecking Crew. Corruption is uniquely reprehensible in a democracy because it violates the system's first principle, which is that government exists to serve the public, not particular individuals. This idea runs so deep that many of us can't bring ourselves to question it, even in this disillusioned age, and despite such massive evidence to the contrary. The political parties may fight over how big government should be and exactly what it should do, we tell ourselves, but surely they all share a basic devotion to the public interest. But the truth is that fantastic misgovernment is not by accident, nor is it the work of a few bad individuals. It's the consequence of triumph by a particular philosophy of government by a movement that sees the liberal state as a perversion and considers the market the ideal nexus for human society. This movement is friendly to industry, not just by force of campaign contributions, but by conviction. It believes in entrepreneurship, not merely in commerce, but in politics, and the inevitable result of its ascendance is the capture of the state by business. The conservatism that speaks through its actions is institutionally opposed to the baseline good intentions we learned about in elementary school. Its leaders laugh off the idea of the public interest as airy-fairy nonsense. They caution against bringing top-notch talent into government service. They declare war on public employees. They have made a cult of outsourcing and privatizing. They have wrecked established federal operations because they disagree with them, and they have deliberately piled up an Everest of debt in order to force the government into crisis. The ruination they have wrought has been thorough. It has been a professional job. Repairing it will require years of political action. The foregoing was written some time ago, but massive mismanagement of the capitalist financial system has come to a head. I find it hard to fault any of the author's points. The United States government is taking on as much as $700 billion worth of obligations removed from the backs of financial organizations which suck blood out of the system while siphoning billions into their own pockets. Under George Wanker Bush, the ultimate Terminator, American federal debt promises to be well over $10 trillion by the time he retires to his ranch, guarded from citizen wrath by Secret Service officers, paid for from the public purse George has done his best to deplete. No one has a plan for repaying this debt stretching to 13 zeros. It could not be repaid without gutting the American economy for decades. It will be carried forward to either be defaulted upon or depleted by inflation. Since the U.S. government owes its creditors in U.S. dollars, it could conceivably pay off these demanding repayment by running the printing presses. Do you have a $1 million treasury bill coming due? Here's a $1 million bill. Have a nice day. Of course, when those $1 million bills come out, your 20 will be worth less than the toilet paper sheet, and you will find how Zimbabweans feel. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. We're hearing reports that Canada's natural gas reserves are being oversubscribed. Gone are the days of Trudeau's National Energy Program and its rule that there had to be a proven reserve for 30 years of Canada's needs before any gas could be exported. There is no mandated reserve for our use anymore. Now the first cubic meter of gas from a well can be put in a pipe and sent south. If Canadians are not willing to pay more than Americans, off it goes. America allows no such free depletion of native gas supplies. The U.S. Natural Gas Act of 1938 prohibits export of domestic gas without the approval of the Department of Energy. We have no parallel act for Canada. News of the latest betrayal of Canada's posterity comes from Kitimat. Proposals for a terminal to process imported liquefied natural gas for domestic distribution have been altered. Now the plan calls for the plant to liquefy Canadian gas for export. The rationale is that overseas supplies of LNG are mostly committed, not available for import. So let's just jump into the market and export our temporary surplus. When that surplus becomes deficit, we can just reverse the flow and replace our needs at multiples of what we receive from exports, if they're available. This has to rank with the dumbest operations that our governments are approving. Again, it appears to be that present corporate profit is more important than future needs of citizens. Our skidoo-riding Minister of Public Safety, a born-again believer, has faith. He has faith that spending $120 million to keep narcotics out of Canadian prisons will succeed at a time when the war on drugs has proven an abject failure. He pandered to misguided public perception by declaring that this kind of effort can eliminate the problem of drugs behind bars. Yes, there are drugs getting into prisons. No, the smuggling of these drugs into institutions cannot be eliminated. Strip searches, dogs, and technical detectors can reduce the flow, but the main effect will be to make smuggled drugs more expensive, tempt workers to corruption, and increase profits for organizations like the Hells Angels, which will, without fail, fill a demand. Jails are not insulated institutions, isolated from society. Every day, guards come and go as supplies are delivered and waste removed. With the privatization of so many services, like food provision and maintenance, all manner of delivery persons and tradesmen enter supposedly secure areas. A tightening of security will tempt these people to make a quick buck by engaging in a bit of entrepreneurship. This is not to say that drugs are not a problem for guards and order in the system. It's just that the flow cannot be stopped, and the effect of tightening depends upon the type of drug smuggled. The most benign are easiest to stop. Increased inspection will catch the bulky, odorous drugs like marijuana, while missing the really nasty ones like crystal meth and crack. The most dangerous drug in the prison system is alcohol. When prisoners concoct a brew from fruits, the results can be disastrous. I know from experience that it's almost impossible to prevent prisoners from making these brews, as they can be fermented in garbage bags wedged into a crevice. On the other hand, when I was a guard, I knew it would be a quiet night when I smelled marijuana smoke. Drugs of all kinds are in great demand by prisoners as they alleviate boredom and fend off withdrawal symptoms for addicts. Drugs of one sort or another will find their way into our institutions, and if Stockwell Day's $120 million stems marijuana that pacifies, it will promote crystal meth and crack, which drive violence. Guards will pay the price with increased assaults, and the public will pick up the tab for repairs after riots. On the surface, it looks stupid and short-sighted, but upon reflection, it's cunning. I refer to the Campbell administration's intent to use windfall profits from sale of rights for mining and energy sales to reduce taxes. Reducing British Columbia's indebtedness wins no votes, but another cut in taxes can always be counted upon to garner applause. Lower tax rates are a time bomb for successive regimes. When the windfall is squandered, it will be left to future administrations to convince the public that those lower taxes were temporary and must be restored to pay for government. This is just what Bush has done, leaving an economy smothered in fiscal toxic waste for the next president to deal with. Those of you who listen to Democracy Now!, read any of Noam Chomsky's works, or Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, will find this familiar. Naomi Klein's book does a chillingly effective job of assembling case histories illustrating a tactic used by those who plan to seize national power. Her thesis is simple. Those who want to replace an established civil order first create disorder. It's when there's turmoil and ordinary institutions fail to serve the population that people will accept, indeed demand, a powerful leader who will save them. History is replete with examples. A good historical example is that of Germany in the wake of World War I. The Weimar Republic was unable to control inflation and the economy was in ruins. You know the stories of people taking wheelbarrows of cash to buy a loaf of bread. With total economic collapse, the situation was ripe for dictatorship promising stability. We know the rest. Hyperinflation was the shock that allowed the destruction of German democracy. Salvador Allende empowered the poor in Chile, much as Chavez is doing now in Venezuela. The grip of the ruling class was being eroded, and they had to destroy the upstart Allende or watch themselves lose absolute power, holding them above the laws. They used the Chilean army under General Pinochet to overthrow Allende and establish a brutal dictatorship. This was plotted and overseen by disciples of Milton Friedman, the late right-wing fanatic from the University of Chicago. They had the gracious help of the American government, which had earlier assured that Chile's army was diverted from defending the nation to controlling internal dissent. I know, as I was a small cog in the machine that armed and trained the Chilean officers. Klein uses other examples, large and small, like the way Soviet apparatchiks used the shock of the Soviet Union's collapse to loot public assets and become capitalist moguls. It was the shock of Hurricane Katrina allowing the rebuilding of New Orleans from a city with a vast, poor, largely black population to a mostly white theme park free of institutions, including Cheney's Halliburton, sucked billions from the public purse behind the cover of emergency relief, leaving behind a free enterprise trophy. There have been alliances of dictatorships established behind shocks, like Hitler's alliance with Mussolini, like the temporary alliance of South American dictatorships in the 80s, all taken over after shock-induced destruction of their democratic institutions. Suppose there's a plan to go after the big prize. Is it inconceivable that international consensus exists among the rich and powerful, that it would be a good thing to put the upstart lower classes back where they belong in the entire world? This would require controlling the heart of the developed world, the United States of America. No sane person believes that a bunch of egomaniacs meet in basement rooms to plot the takeover of the U.S. This is not necessary. All that's needed is that drastic shock that will take Americans themselves, demand that all power be handed to a band promising to save them from chaos. Could this be happening right now? There's a confluence of interest, unspoken except in the bowels of think tanks, that encourages small preparations for that shock. Groundwork was laid in the 70s when the Trilateral Commission declared that the U.S. had a crisis of democracy, that is, too much democracy, eroding the power of people who believed that those who own the nation should govern it. They believed the lower and middle classes had achieved too much power. Roosevelt's reform, reducing control by the rich, had to be rolled back. Social Security, government welfare, legislation empowering unions, these and more had to go. Look at subsequent events. Unions have become an irrelevance in most sectors of the U.S. and Canada. Unions used to negotiate from a position of power, gaining middle-class status for their members. Those that survive are now forced to accept layoffs, wage cuts, and loss of benefits. George Bush attempted to dismantle the U.S. Social Security system, turning the pensions of Americans over to the vagaries of the same financiers who brought us the subprime mortgage mess. His was not a defeat, but a setback, as Social Security is still a target for privatization under John McCain. From a maximum rate of 95% during World War II, income taxes for the highest earners in the U.S. have been slashed to nuisance levels. Warren Buffett, billionaire American, calculated that his personal tax rate is lower than any of his staff's. This, and rollbacks of inheritance taxes, wealth taxes, and capital gains levies, have allowed a blossoming of billionaires who are effectively above the law or nationality. The overlying tool allowing the slow destruction of the middle classes and developed nations is globalization. Those who pushed free trade and economic integration promised a level playing field. Just think, 1 billion Chinese customers for North American products if we just abolish tariffs and barriers to trade. So we watched the deals progress, but the billions of customers who were not buying our manufacturers, except for the machinery allowing them to compete with us for a position of minuscule wages and few impediments like environmental laws. Suddenly we found that our jobs had gone east and the mall warts were filled with stuff North Americans used to make. Yes, the playing field is being leveled, but we're seeing so much, not seeing so much the massive uplifting of the Asian masses, but the rollback of our living standards. Was this a miscalculation? No, it was foreseen and welcomed by those who benefit from moving factories to low-wage jurisdictions and selling their output to us at inflated prices. Does Chrysler see the effect, what the effect will be of importing cheap Chinese cars to Canada? You betcha. These imports will be used to force further wage cuts on domestic workers. For North American auto workers, it will be low wages here or production will be moved offshore completely. Okay, these are nibbling around the edges, not bringing that grand shock that will induce public demand for massive changes, changes that would incidentally cement the power of the rich and their lackeys. We see forebodings of that shock on the horizon. It is hyperinflation, like that which ushered in the rule of one Adolf Hitler. But this hyperinflation would be worldwide. Economists and think tanks are beginning to talk about hyperinflation, mostly behind closed doors. The possibility has not yet dawned on the greater public. When oil that sold for $10 a barrel a few years ago now goes for $100, that does not indicate that oil is worth more. That barrel still contains the same potential energy. It's not oil that's gone up, but money that has lost its value. Corn and wheat prices have exploded, but a bushel of either still provides the same number of calories. I just bought a pair of laces for my boots. It occurred to me that these fancy pieces of string cost more than my first pair of laces, laces which included the boots. I bought a bag of sunflower seeds for wild birds. Last year, one cost $20. Today, it was $30. You've all seen similar jumps. Gold, which sold for $35 an ounce in the 70s, is now flirting with $1,000. Is it really worth more? Everywhere we look, prices are not just rising, they're jumping. Even while they do, we're told that by the good folks at Statistics Canada, the inflation is within their target range of 2 or 3%. Anyone who has any awareness of prices knows this figure is bullshit. Official figures are manipulated to cover up for inflation. I read recently the good news that year-over-year prices had dropped by 0.1%. This was due to a dramatic drop in oil. Funny thing, but when oil was skyrocketing, we were told this was irrelevant, as core inflation was under control. Core inflation excluded food and fuel, so they are included in official calculations when going down, and excluded when rising. Once hyperinflation takes hold, it's difficult to control. When the economy is in free fall, it may be impossible. And, contrary to what George Bush may say, fundamentals are not sound. George has overseen the systematic destruction of the American dollar. When he arrived in the White House, he inherited a budget with a surplus which, if maintained, would have allowed the national debt to be paid off in a decade. He turned that around by massive spending on pet wars and massive cuts in taxes for the wealthy. Now the U.S. has a debt that will never be repaid. Holders of that debt are increasingly nervous about the future of Treasury paper. It's foreseeable that there will be a run on the dollar, reducing that paper to next to nothing. Talk of a world economy is now mature enough to withstand an American economic collapse is more bullshit. If they go down, we all go down, especially Canada. And what happens when our money is suddenly drastically devalued? Wages will have no buying power. Economic activity will grind to a halt. Food and energy supplies will dry up. Suddenly, an economy which has evolved away from self-sufficiently to total independence will not be able to feed, clothe, warm, or protect us. We will collectively demand restoration of a system that we need for bare survival. And yes, help would be to hand, but at a price. Just as Pinochet wiped the slate when he took over Chile. When the smoke cleared, we would find ourselves bereft of social supports. The remaining world system will be feudal. This closes the 285th edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Rebroadcasts on CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake and CHLS in Lillooet.